you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Wood against Georgia. Not only didn't understand us, he didn't understand the statute or the case. We'll wait for the noise to subside, counsel. We'll wait for a moment or two here. I think you may proceed whenever you're ready now, Mr. Zell.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. This case involves an issue that was left open in Tate versus Short. And that is, may a trial judge revoke the probation of the probationer or offender if he does not have the funds to make the monthly payments? The facts in this case are, I think, rather clear. There are three probationers, of course, three petitioners in this court: Raymond Wood, Edna Allen, and Raymond Tant. They were convicted several years ago of distributing obscene materials. The record showed that Mr. Wood was a clerk in a bookstore. No dispute about that. Miss Allen was a projectionist in a theater, and Mr. Tant was the projectionist in that theater. The fine imposed on Mr. Tant and Miss Allen was a $5,000 fine and 12 months on probation. That was after the conviction. They were to pay that fine as directed, which was $500 per month. So they would have paid the fine in approximately 10 months.
And that was a condition of the probation?
That's correct. Mr. Wood was convicted in two counts, and he received a $5,000 fine on each count to run consecutively, and 12 months on probation. Therefore, he had a 24-month sentence and a $10,000 fine payable, again, at the rate of $500 per month over a period of 20 months. Thereafter, I appealed the case to the Georgia Court of Appeals, and I lost. I then certiorari'd the Georgia Supreme Court, and certiorari was denied. I then certiorari'd this court, and cert was denied, with some justices dissenting. The case came back to the trial court, the remitter, that is, and of course, while the case is on appeal in Georgia, as in most states and federal system, the three petitioners or offenders, defendants, were not on probation. The conviction, I think, was in March of 77. The remitters came back in October of 1978. And at that point, the three offenders, the three defendants, started serving their probation right at the last week of October. And the record shows that the probation officers told each one — there was a different officer for each defendant. I don't know why there were three different probation officers. But anyway, each one said, you must pay your fine at the end of next month at the rate of $500 per month. In the record at page 71, I notified the court immediately when they were put on probation that they did not have the funds and the fine should be remitted or suspended or some action taken, because there was going to be a problem in this case on this $20,000 in fines.
On your theory, then, the court is powerless to impose any punishment?
Oh, no. The court is certainly has certain powers to enforce payments on the installment basis. So you have your civil penalties, certainly, garnishment, levy on any property. For example, Mr. Tant was a prison guard at this time, while I was on probation. Mr. Wood had a job at a trucking company, I believe. He could have been garnished. And Ms. Allen, unfortunately, was on unemployment compensation. I don't think you can garnish that. I'm not sure if you can.
Doesn't Georgia have some exemptions to its garnishment statute for necessary expenses of living?
There's a certain percentage after, I think it used to be 50% or there, and then it's a little lower, but there's a certain percentage you can only take it for garnishment. And certainly some small sum of money could have been affected by garnishment at this point.
Well, so your complaint is not that a fine was levied on someone who couldn't pay it.
Not at all.
But that the fine was too high.
Correct. Or not commensurate with, first of all, the administration of justice. What do you do with people who violate the law, and the judge, trial judge, makes a determination that these people can be released on the streets, in society, in public? They're not a danger. They shouldn't be incarcerated. They shouldn't be warehoused, so to speak.
Mr. Zell, if you prevail here, what's going to happen? Mandatory imprisonment in every case of an indigent?
Well, I'd like to think in our system of justice that trial judges will not take that position. I'm sure some will. But I'd like to think that a trial judge...
I'm asking whether your argument might turn out to be counterproductive.
It could, yes. I'm aware of some trial judges have told me that if they can't lock up an indigent defendant on probation, they're going to give straight time sentences. I'm sure that's a possibility.
My other question is, have these prison sentences been served?
In this case?
Yes.
Oh, no, the judge let them stay out on bond pending this appeal because they would have served their sentence if they had been incarcerated.
So the sentences have been stayed?
That's correct.
And they have not been served?
That's correct.
What were the sentences? How much jail time will they spend?
Mr. Tant received, and Ms. Allen received, a 12-month sentence each. Under the computation, this is a high and aggravated misdemeanor. They get 4 days.
Well, I know, but the sentence was, they were put on probation first, right?
Yes, and they served almost 3 months of that sentence.
And
they have nine left.
And was the probation was the same length as their sentences?
That's correct.
I see.
That's right. Correct.
So they go back and serve. They
9 months less good time, which is 4 days a month in this case, which would be 36 days less 9 months. So they'd serve about 8 months. Mr. Wood has 2 years, 24 months on probation. He has served again 3 months, so he has 21 left to go. Less 4 days a month for the remaining 21 months.
Does this record show from what resources their bond was provided to if they were indigent and couldn't pay the fine? The bond cost some money, I suppose,
yes.
In Georgia?
The bond was provided for by their previous employer. He put up the bond for them.
What does this record show about the previous employer's practice in paying fines?
Well, what happened was, and it's in the record, of course, that they were first fined in this case. Then thereafter, they were charged again in another case, I think each one was, and a small fine was imposed and paid by their employer. Paid by their employer through me. The fine was paid and they received something like very small suspended sentences. The fines, I might add, it's not in the record, were much smaller than in this case. There were a $750 fine, something like that. And then when the remitter came down in the first appeal, the employer did not pay the fines in this case for certain reasons, such as a different change of attitude and a different employer. Different
Are these petitioners here in Pharma Pauperis?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, doesn't that suggest some validity to Mr. Justice Blackmun's observation that if the people are before the court for the first time or the second time, but for the fifth time, and the court feels that we don't want to warehouse these people and lock them up with murderers, but if we can't do anything else to them, if they're indigent and small, or the small-time fines haven't deterred them before, isn't there going to be a tendency to at least send them to the facility for confinement?
Okay, let me just, we're a little wrong in the chronology. The second cases were imposed after this sentence. This was their first conviction. They stayed in the stayed working at the theater and bookstore, and they were arrested and pled guilty and received a fine thereafter, this sentence, though. And thereafter, they were before different judges, and they received a much more modest fine, I think something under less than $1,000. And it was paid by their employer because they were working there. They were useful to the employer to keep working at the theater and bookstore. Then when they went on probation, they had to quit.
Well, is that really a very commendable motive, that the employer pays their fine because they were convicted of doing something that was illegal under Georgia law?
Well, certainly you can't enforce any agreement between the employer and the employee against public policy like enforcing a gambling contract. He promised to pay him. In some instances, he did pay the fine. As soon as they left work, he didn't pay the fines.
Is this a common provision in Georgia between employees of so-called adult bookstores and their employers?
Yes and no. It many times the employer has paid the fines for employees. Many times he has not. I just filed a cert in this court last week involving a case called Simpson versus Georgia, in which he received a $20,000 fine in a different theater, different business. And he's supposed to pay $1,000 a month, and he was a short order cook. And the judge again revoked his probation because he not paid $1,000 a month.
Mr. Zell, you have pre-sentence reports in Georgia.
That's correct.
But don't they show how much a man's worth?
That's correct.
So the judge knew that he had enough money to pay this fine, didn't he?
Well, what happened?
And I assume that
the judge knew. Well, here's what happened, Your Honor. Being as a practical matter. When they were convicted in the first instance, the judge, Judge Alexander, was aware of what they were doing. They were making nominal amounts of money as a clerk projectionist. I'm sure the judge thought, and it's rather obvious from the record, that he thought if you impose this large fine, their employer would pay it. I'm sure that was the thrust of why the fine was so heavy, was so large. Your employer will pay it based on maybe other cases or at prodding of the prosecutor, saying, fine and big, don't worry, it'll be taken care of.
And the employer was just treating this as a cost of doing business, or
that's
a
correct.
Licensing fee.
That's correct. Side of licensing, that's correct.
So he is here in form of pumpers now.
No, these people are the mere employees.
The employee?
What
yes.
would happen if...
They're not working there anymore.
Yeah, what happened if the pre-sentence report shows that Mr. Jones has a friend by the name of Mr. Smith, and Mr. Smith will give him $1,000, and they fine him $1,000, and they're not working together or anything, this is just a friend, would the court be entitled to go back on that?
Well,
on the fact that he used some bad information.
Certainly he should. The court, again...
Well, when you get through, I want no difference in that case in this case.
Well, certainly he should. The judge should modify the condition of probation, the fine, if there was some misinformation, obviously, or even a promise by the defendant. You know, many defendants get before
Did
a trial.
Did you, at that time, tell the judge that the man couldn't pay the fine?
No, there was no representation made. The trial
so
was...
Nobody... He just let the judge go down that road.
That's correct. What happened is...
You want to complain about the judge.
Well, I don't know if
You're
I'm complaining.
You're not complaining about yourself at all.
Well, what happened is the trial was over. The jury returned a verdict of guilty. At that point, the prosecutor, and it's not in the record, but I can say, prodded the judge to impose a large fine. That's normally what is done in these cases, large fines. The judge was aware of their employment. And I think the judge, as in many of these cases, felt that a third party would pay the fine. We did not tell the judge the third party would pay the fine. The judge was aware of the facts. I did not know if the third party would pay the fine at that point. There was no guarantee, so to speak, at that point. The case was then appealed. We did not ask for a large fine. It was just a prodding of the prosecutor and the
but
judge imposed it.
You didn't represent the third party. You represented this man.
During the trial in the first instance, that's correct.
And you still do.
Represent the third party?
No.
The defendants?
Yeah.
Yes, before this court, yes, I do.
You are not a court-appointed counsel?
That's correct. I was not.
So he's here as an indigent and former pauperous, but he has paid counsel, then, I take it.
No. The defendants in this case, the way it came about was I received a call. I wrote the court a letter, felt obligated to let the court know that the defendants did not have the money after the appeal was terminated. And they're no longer working for the owner of the theater. And I notified the court that they did not have the funds and the police take some action. They're no longer working there and there's going to be some problem. They did not have the money, would not be forthcoming. The court chose not to take any action, and it's in the record at page 71, and they continue to report on probation. And that's the last I heard of it. I then received a call the first week of January saying that they want me down in court, that I represent these three defendants, and I come down to court to represent them. I contacted the three defendants, and I asked them, did they have money for counsel? Would they want me to represent them? I would be glad to. And they said, yes, we want you as our lawyer, familiar with our case. And so I went down to court to represent them at that point.
But you received a call from the court?
I several, from the defendants, from the court, from the solicitor, concerning the hearing. I received a notice of the hearing date. And, of course, the defendants called me and notified me that they were in some trouble and what could I do for them.
But not from the third party?
No, that's correct. Not from the third party.
I still want to know, you represent them officially here?
The defendants.
And not the third party?
That's correct. That's correct. I've not been paid for this case, and that's in the record. I think the solicitor brought out aptly during the trial that I had represented the defendants, but I was paid by the theater owner at the time of their trial when they were working for the theater owner. But as soon as they were put on probation, their employment was terminated, and therefore the ties were severed with the third party or the employer.
It's clear, isn't it, Mr. Zell, that the monthly installment repayments were conditions of the probation.
Absolutely.
It was made clear that were these repayments not made, the probation would be revoked and the custodial sentences would be imposed.
Okay. At that point, the fines were imposed. That's correct. There was no
isn't,
case...
Isn't that clear that it was a condition of the probation?
Absolutely. Yes, it was a condition of the probation.
Well,
yes.
Would it be... And it's not contended that the prison sentences imposed, which were probated in this court, in this case, were temporarily, were excessive under the law. They were authorized by statute.
Within the statute, yes. They were. There was the maximum fine is $5,000.
Would it be permissible for a judge to impose an authorized prison sentence and probate it, depending, say, on the condition that the convicted defendant stand on his head at 12 noon every day, and then if it turned out that the defendant didn't know how to stand on his head, he'd go to prison?
I think that's what we're into in this case. It's mm-hmm. just an unreasonable condition.
Well, let's say the judge knew at the time he imposed the probated sentence that the convict didn't know how to stand on his head. If he could have imposed the prison sentence from the word go, couldn't he have imposed an impossible condition?
It becomes an illusionary sentence. It gives him a taste of liberty to see what they could raise. And if you can't raise the money, in prison you go. It's really an illusory sentence. That's what I point out in my brief.
Well, from the point of view of the defendants, isn't it better than a straight sentence from the beginning?
No question about it. But what do you do when the judge makes a determination, and assume he did, that these people should not be put in prison?
Well, but wasn't part of his determination the fact that they would be subject to some penalty, i.e. the payment of a fine?
Well,
he didn't intend to let them off scot-free.
And wasn't his decision, as indicated here, that they shouldn't be imprisoned if they paid $500 a month?
That's correct. That's correct. Hoping that somebody...
Well, otherwise, that they should be. That's the implicit condition.
No question about it. That's correct. And all I'm saying before this court is when you have this situation is that other alternatives should be made available to the court and for the defendants, such as community service work, be much more constructive. How does this serve the administration of justice, the prison system? For example, in Georgia, the last
We're not running the Georgia prison system. I mean, that's up to Georgia to provide it if it falls within the United States Constitution.
Yes, but how does that help further the objective in this case? Why do you want to incarcerate somebody for not having the money? What, you then have this classification, suspect classification. poverty versus non-poverty.
Is that a suspect classification? San Antonio versus Rodriguez?
Well, I took the position in my brief, and I take it now, that in social and economic policies, it perhaps is not. But involving criminal justice, it should be. For the purpose of having the money, a man goes scot-free. Such in this case, what if one of the probationers came up with the money? Mr. Wood was able to raise the money, went back in the business, and that's open to him perhaps, goes back in the adult book business, gets the money, and pays his fine. He goes scot-free, so to speak.
Well, you're suggesting that paying $5,000 is not somewhat painful.
Well, it's painful if you don't have it. I'm saying that if the person, they go out and steal it.
You mean it isn't painful if you have to go out and borrow it and put a mortgage on your house?
Certainly is, if you have the financial resources to borrow the money. If you have the house.
Well, you're not suggesting that indigents should be free from any penalty for criminal conduct.
Not at all. Of course not.
But the consequence comes out that way on your argument.
That's correct. If you use money as a criteria and the lack of money to go to jail, and I think we have millions of people unemployed in this country at the present time, I think it doesn't serve any purpose, to lock up people who do not have the money.
Well, if these people are in fact indigents, as you suggest, putting them to work at community service instead of incarcerating them isn't going to enable them to support their families.
Well, what you do is, and this is just a suggestion, I mean, not the only suggestion, is that if you give them community service work, perhaps on weekends, at nights, there are many ways to serve the community, and much more productive for the community and for the system. Help the society in which they committed the wrong. It's certainly much more noble than to just lock somebody up behind bars for 7 or 8 months because they don't have the money. This case involves, I'm sure the judge felt, and I conceded, that a third party would pay the money, and it's not been forthcoming. That's obviously the judge had that basis. This is similar in the Hunter versus Dean case in which this court granted cert. It was like a 10-year sentence to be placed on probation if you paid a $2,000 fine in advance. The defendant made a representation he could pay the money, and he could not pay it, and he was locked up. Same with Barnett versus Hooper, you granted cert in that case as well, and vacated as moot. Same representation was made, I could pay the money if you just give me probation. And the judge did, and he couldn't pay the money. And the question is, do you lock people up where they don't have the money? There should be other alternative means. This involves traffic cases, misdemeanors, or felonies.
But you don't question, Mr. Zell, as I understand it, that the judge, so far as the Georgia statutes went, could have imposed these prison sentence right at the outset, sentences, without any probation whatsoever.
That's correct. He made a determination they should be on probation at that point. That's correct.
Well, he made a determination they should be on probation if they paid $500 a month.
Oh, no. Well,
that was a condition of the probation that he imposed.
They could go on probation, but they should pay $500 a month while they're on probation.
Right.
And if they don't pay that $500 a month, they're to go to jail.
Right.
Well, they're also go to jail if they don't live up to the other terms
that's
of probation,
right.
Even if they pay the $500.
That's correct.
So it isn't just a condition.
That's one of several conditions.
Right, which is in the appendix. That's right. Correct. And in this case, no, there was none. They did not proceed against the employer. Why? I don't remember why. I'm not sure why. It was merely against the two employees. And clearly, again, the trial judge relied on the employer, frankly, I think, to pay the fines. And now he's not going to do it because of change of ownership, I might add. He's gone now, and the money is not forthcoming. And I don't see how, under Tate versus Short and Williams versus Illinois, that you could, this court can lock it, take the position to say that a man who doesn't have the funds goes to jail with the man or the defendant who has the funds, able to raise it through an employer or a friend, does not go to jail. How do you square this case with the Tate case and the Williams case?
Yet you concede that the judge could have sentenced him ab initio to 12 months.
In the very beginning.
Yes.
That's correct. That's correct. He felt that there were good subjects, fit subjects, to be on probation, that they should not be incarcerated. Okay. He made that determination.
Well, but isn't that a typical determination with the case of nonviolent first or second offenders?
Generally speaking, I would say so, yes. I might add that the American Bar Association of Standards relating to sentencing suggests that when a judge imposes a sentence, that he look at the profitability in the crime, what kind of nonviolent crime, but it also suggests, the American Bar Association, that they not revoke a man's probation if he doesn't have the ability to pay the fine. And of all the law review articles I've read, and all the cases I could find, there's not one case except in Georgia, as far as I know, in shepherdizing Tate and Williams, where a court has said if you don't have the money on the installment basis, you go to jail.
What if the judge had said this, well, I'm sentencing you to a year in jail, but I'm going to put you on probation, subject to normal probation conditions. But I'm also going to fine you $5,000 payable in installments. And if you fail to pay the installments, you go to jail for 10 days. That's a separate, I must have some way of something to take the place of the fine, but I'll just send you to jail for 10 days if you don't pay the fine. But of course, you're subject to going to jail for a year if you don't live up to the other to the conditions of your probation. Would you be here then?
I think so. Yes. I don't think a man should serve one day in jail based on his wealth. I think that should be a suspect category if it isn't already under the Griffin versus Illinois case. And I think that should be a criteria. It serves no purpose to either raise revenue, punish the defendant, because he sits in jail knowing if he had the money, he'd be out. While other defendants and other clients I've had have paid the fine and not sitting in jail. I think it caused discredit to the system of justice.
So you're saying that all criminal statutes that says 30 days or $100 are unconstitutional?
Under your decisions, yes, if you don't have the money.
Whether that's true or not, I don't think we've held that yet.
No. We expressly reserved it.
And yes. But that's your submission is that $100 or one day is bad.
No.
What?
Only if the individual does not have the funds.
All right. But that's bad to apply to any indigent.
Or a person who has not squandered the money away, has not been negligent, willful. That seems to be the federal, at least in the circuit, I'm from the Fifth Circuit and the Fourth Circuit, where they've reached that issue.
What if he squandered the money? What difference does that make?
Well, I think then the court, such as in a, I'm using, analogizing the divorce rule in a man supporting his family. If he squanders away money that he didn't give to his family, he could be held in contempt of court. And I think this would be similar. If he squandered the money away or had a good job that he turned down to make a lot of money, willfully didn't work, I think then the court can use that as a criteria to revoke him, put him in jail, because he's not trying under his probation to pay the fine.
And you think it's the function of this court to evaluate considerations of that kind?
No, it's the trial judge. The trial judge.
But then if you say it's a consideration there, you're by implication saying we must pass on that sometime.
Well, certainly,
said this is a constitutional issue.
Certainly, if a man is incarcerated, no question about it. If he's incarcerated and there's no evidence to put him in jail, I think a writ of habeas corpus would lie. If a man is put in jail for no reason, whether it be he has no funds or for whatever reason, the judge thought he ought to go to jail for no reason. He just didn't like the way his hair was too long. I had a case like that recently where judge revoked a man's probation because his hair was too long, and I think I luckily reversed that in the state courts, but a writ would lie. You can't lock a man up for no reason.
What if a man were convicted of first-degree murder and had no funds?
Yes.
Would you say he couldn't go to jail?
You mean of course, in Georgia, if you're convicted of first-degree murder, you must either get a life or death sentence. I'm only talking about where you're placed on probation or given some kind of suspended sentence and use wealth, money, as the criteria to lock them up.
But isn't part of the trial judge's reasoning that you want to put as few people in jail as possible?
That's correct.
And if he knew that you couldn't
collect the fine
or put him in jail, he probably would sentence him to jail in the first place.
Well, I'm going to take it from a theoretical point of view, if I may. I like to think that trial judges will make a determination and I think they're duty-bound to do this, whether a man should go to jail or not, regardless of money, regardless of other criteria, whether first instance should he put him out on the street, serve his sentence in society first. If he makes that determination, as they did in this case, he then decides what are the penalties to impose upon the defendant, such as a fine, community service, weekends in jail, what other a myriad amount of things he could use to so to speak, punish the man, or not punish him, but make him helpful to the community. Primarily, I'm considering community service work would be the best thing to do with people who don't have funds. That helps himself. He pays a penalty. He loses recreational time on weekends and at nights, and he also helps the community by doing some charitable work. What is the purpose of collecting this money? Are we saying the government doesn't have the money to run itself? What, is this a revenue-producing measure? What are we furthering by saying you pay this money? It's important in the system of criminal justice. It isn't important. It's very unimportant to collect money. And the judges, trial judges, should realize this, I think, and most of them do, frankly. And to use money as a criteria to put a man in jail, among murderers perhaps, and he sits in jail and he says, golly, my friend paid the fine, and I can't. And he goes free because he had money. I think this is a discredit to our system of justice, and it should not be allowed, and I think you should follow the Tate and Williams case, this court should, and not permit this for one day.
What it comes down to is to find a punishment that is available for imposition on him, and I suppose some people, due to circumstances, are free from any punishment except going to jail.
Free from paying money. First of all, most defendants violate the law because they don't have money, obviously. Poverty, I'm sure, causes a lot of crime. I don't think there's any question about it. And so most defendants are broke and have no money. So the imposition of fines on people who are broke or poor or have no money or have robbed or stolen to get money is just inconsistent. It's just catching yourself going around in circles.
Would you object if the court had a hearing and found out that this man could pay $10 a week?
Not at all. In fact...
Well, I thought you weren't saying it right then.
That's correct. In fact, I asked the judge, I said, look, Judge, reduce the fine. Let's make it commensurate. This was revoked, failing to pay as directed. $500 a month. There's nothing with the judge saying, well, I misread this. I thought you can pay $500. I'll reduce it to $10 a month, which may be as much to this individual defendant as $1,000 a week would be to some other defendants who are perhaps involved in a RICO conviction, organized crimes conviction.
Your time is up, but just one question, at least from me, pursuing Justice Blackmun's question. Could the judge under Georgia law have said, I will consider probation if you will post a bond to guarantee the payment of your fine over a period of time as a guarantee for these installments? Would that be permitted under Georgia law?
I don't think so. I think the sentence clearly reads a sentence or fine or both, and I don't think it's permissible. But again, the bond would be based on his wealth to post the money, needed money.
Mr. Zell, let me ask you one more question. So supposing that an armed robber, convicted of armed robbery, came before the judge for sentencing, under your going around in circles argument, would it be a constitutional defense for him to say, I just didn't have any money, I couldn't get a job, and so I just had to commit this armed robbery?
Well, I'm sure many defendants have said that to the trial judge. I certainly would advise this client that I was representing to say that. All we're saying is that after the judge makes a determination that he could be on the street, that he could be on probation, that he has a suspended sentence, don't lock him up later for not having wealth, not having material goods.
I don't want to repeat myself, but the determination that the sentencing judge made was that he would continue him on probation so long as he paid $500 a month.
I think
it wasn't
yes.
an unconditional determination.
No, it was conditioned on paying the money. That's correct.
Among other conditions.
That's correct. It was conditioned on his wealth, on money, and he could not reach me. He could reach the other conditions of probation. There were about 10 of them. In the record. But the condition he couldn't reach was the wealth, the money condition, and that shouldn't be a criteria or reason to lock him in.
And other people who could satisfy that condition, and who could satisfy all the conditions, stayed out of jail.
Who could pay the money could stay out of jail. And if the court determines that, that this man paid the money and stayed at, and that led me an reverse discrimination. Then the court said, well, I'm going to make you do some community service work. Put in a lot of hours, assuming your time is worth a minimum wage, $3 an hour, and work on weekends or at nights, working this fine off in the community.
One of my colleagues noted, it isn't our business to try to write Georgia's statute on that subject.
But certainly it's available to the judge under Georgia law. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Dunsmore.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, the issue in this case is whether a judge can condition probation on the payment of a fine, revoke that period of probation for non-payment of a fine, particularly when the individual has represented to the court that they had the funds or the means by which to pay the fine. Underlying that consideration is whether the sentencing judge could properly consider third-party sources as assisting the individual in the payment of the fine. Now, this case does not involve, as some cases previously to the court have provided, extending the period of confinement greater than allowed by statute.
We're not. Attorney General, suppose a man has got money and he is sentenced to pay $5,000 a month, which is no problem to him. But he starts serving his sentence at the end of the year 1929, and he gets caught along with everybody else. In Georgia, what happened? Well, is there any relief for him?
Yes, he can always go through it. In Georgia, at any time when the court, and we pointed that in a footnote, the court always has the inherent power to modify a sentence or to release the individual from the conditions of his probation during that time. Normal procedure as to what percentage of the cases, I could not indicate to you, but that is a means available to a defendant.
You go to the sentencing judge?
You go to the sentencing judge because he retains jurisdiction over that case during that time that the individual is on a period of probation. Now, I think it's important in this case that the individuals at this time are not in confinement. And I was under the misapprehension, and I correct that on page 9 of my brief, and I indicated that confinement resulted. It did not, as Mr. Zell said initially. I think the important factor is that these individuals are out on bond, on an appeal bond. That bond was posted on February 13, 1979, which was the date when the judge said that after his hearing in January of 79, if you don't pay the arrears, I'm going to give you 2 weeks to pay the arrearage of approximately $1,500, then I'm going to revoke probation.
What was the amount of that bond?
Now, the bond for Mr. Wood is $20,000, and under the Georgia statutory scheme, the maximum amount that, or the amount that would have to be paid for that bond, according to my figures, would be $1,025. The statute is Georgia Code 27501. That sets out the fact that you can't charge any more than 10% on the first $500 or any more than 5% on amounts over $500. As to the other two petitioners, Ms. Allen and Mr. Tanti, it was a $10,000 bond, and I think my math worked out to something like $525.
Is there anything in the record to indicate where this indigent got the money to pay that?
No, and I think that gets into
the record. I don't want you to pursue it.
I think the
it's in the record.
Interesting part of the case, though, which the court can consider, is in our Appendix A, which is the revocation proceeding in January of 1979. Mr. Zell told the sentencing judge, the trial judge, Judge Alexander, that these individuals' previous fines in connection with other cases had been paid and that he had paid them. Now, I think the...
You said previous fines.
That is correct. Now...
If I misunderstood, Mr. Zell, but I thought that this was their first conviction.
All right. If I can, the scenario is this is their first conviction. This is what happened. Each one of them was arrested, and they pursued their constitutional right to submit the matter before a jury. A jury in March of 1977 found them guilty as charged, And the judge at that time said, I'm going to put you a sentence of 12 months, the maximum for these convictions of distributing obscene materials. It's considered aggravating, a misdemeanor of a high and aggravating nature is 12 months and a $5,000 fine or both. Now, after that time, they appealed to the Court of Appeals, then through the Supreme Court of Georgia, and then a writ of certiorari. In the interim, between the time of the October 23rd, 1978 order, when the judge says, all right, I'm going to, the terms and conditions of probation start on this date, they entered pleas of guilty to subsequent offenses. It was those subsequent offenses which are referred to in our Appendix A on the brief in opposition to writ of certiorari, where Mr. Zell tells the judge, yes, I paid the fines, or the employers gave me the money to pay these fines.
Well, could the judge have revoked the then pending probation because of their conviction of a subsequent crime?
Yes, he could have. I believe he could have, but I think the important part is of the case is that he had, and what we're talking about here is sentencing discretion of a trial judge. What may he consider? Can he consider other things? Now, in United States versus Grayson, this court said, yes, the judge can consider the demeanor of the defendant when he said, I find your defense to be highly incredible, and basically, I think you're putting a sham on the court. By analogy, cannot the trial judge consider representations to him by third parties that we will pay the fines? Now, what does this do in the mind of the trial judge? He says, "Yes, I'm going to give you 12 months and a $5,000 fine, or the 12 months and $5,000 authorized by law."
What does the record show, if anything, about who paid the bond of a fee of $1,000 or more?
Now, the bond as to
the bond for the for continued liberty while this case is going.
Well,
isn't there something in
Mr. Chief Justice Berger? There was not. It was not until the 27th of October that I found out that these individuals had a bond posted. Now, perhaps I was negligent in some regard in not checking this out sooner, but in part I relied in part on the solicitor's office to give me some of the background material that I initially supplied the court with in our brief.
Wasn't there some statement by counsel at one of these hearings that the employer had paid the bond?
Oh, yes, Mr. Chief Justice Berger, yes. That's in regard to two things. I believe the petitioners all said, and this is important, I think, they said that when we were employed, our employers told us that if at any time during our employment we're arrested or anything, we will pay your fines, we will make sure that bond is arranged, and we'll provide you with legal representation. Now, in the appendix, there is indication that the King Bonding Company paid the bonds for these individuals when they were arrested, and I would assume the continuing appeal bonds until October 23rd, 1978.
That's true. Why wasn't the owner arrested?
Mr. Justice Marshall, I have no idea,
yeah,
and I cannot speak for the solicitor in Fulton County. Now, these individuals also indicated, and I think the representation is properly to the court, that here the employer even told them, one of them, I believe it was Mr. Tanti, there's indication in the probation revocation hearing, well, how did you know to get Mr. Zell? I believe there's testimony in there that he had represented them previously. And I believe there's also testimony in that revocation hearing that it had been suggested by the employer to contact Mr. Zell. And there's also indication in the record that I don't think it comes that clearly, in inference that the employer paid Mr. Zell's fee. Now, I think we need to...
Mr. Dunsmore, let me ask you one question about the appendix on page 21. And it's in the last paragraph there where the court states this is the trial court order of probation. It is further order of the court, and the defendant is hereby advised that the court may at any time revoke or modify any conditions of this probation or change the period of probation and may discharge the defendant from probation. Was any application made in this case to discharge the defendant from probation?
None on the record now. And I say that with, well, with the qualified remark that on page 71 of the probation revocation hearing, there is an indication from Mr. Zell that I wrote the court. But I think, as we pointed out in our brief, in this case, at the time the sentences were imposed, the defendants, petitioners in this case, sat back in silence. They never went into the probation officers at that time and said, you know, we can't pay. There's indication that the probation officer said we'll accept partial payments. And they never went in and told or indicated to their probation supervisors that, you know, we could pay a lesser amount. They refused, and I'll use the word refused, to pay the fine because they were under the impression, and I think rightly so, on the conditions of employment, that their employers would pay the fine. And therefore, they took no action. Now, I think what that amounts to in this case, regardless of funds, is are we not deceiving a trial judge? And as Mr. Justice Marshall says, let the judge go down the road. Many times you say, well, can silence be a condoning aspect? I think it can in this situation. I think we're talking about the integrity of the sentencing function of the criminal justice system. To allow criminal defendants to mislead a judge, or that is not to bring to his attention facts that are different, let the judge rely on it, get the benefit of a lesser sentence, and then come back in and say, gee, I'm sorry, we just didn't have any money. Particularly when you had 1 year and 7 months, 19 months, intervening from March of 1977 to October of 1978, when they were actually put under probation supervisors. In that period of time, they had an opportunity to check with their employer and say, are you going to pay the fine? Record is silent. They did nothing. They never at any time went in tried to pay the fine. There's no showing that they went out to see if they could borrow any money, to my understanding. All of them were earning some sort of money, and the word indigent, I think, has been used loosely in this case. We have one individual making $525 a month, another one $400 to $500 a month, and the one lady who's on unemployment.
Did they ever ask the court to reduce the amount of the installments and put them over
none.
A longer period
there was
of time?
No effort made at any time to reduce the installments or to seek anything else. As a matter of fact, on page 69 of the appendix A, which is not the Brown appendix but the one that appended to our brief in opposition, the judge Alexander says, I didn't ask the question because I thought I could enforce the agreement. Right there, there's evidence right there that the judge was under the impression that the third parties would pay this fine. Now, why should a judge be able to look to third parties? In the probation context, just as if we're putting an individual out on parole, we're trying to find an alternative to confinement. Now, an alternative to confinement has the purpose of rehabilitation. We want to de-minimize the amount of supervision that the court has to engage in. Now, if the court can look to a citizen, an employer, or somebody in the community, that aids the court in its carrying out of its rehabilitative function. Particularly, in the context when we put a man on parole, one of the things parole boards generally ask, where are you going in the community? Who will vouch for you? Do you have a job? Is there somebody in the community grassroots that we can look to assist us in rehabilitating you? Now, that same factor must be viewed in the eyes of the sentencing judge. Now, Mr. Zell and the petitioners say, well, gee, that was an illegal agreement. That is, if illegal to the extent that you presuppose that the individual is hired with the purpose of violating the law. But I think the judge rationally could look to the employers, because if they put a stake up in the community for an employer, there's going to be continued employment. Now, one of the terms of the probation was that they continue on employment. If that individual is working, he can contribute to his family. He doesn't come a burden to society. The collection of fine in this case is not like Tate versus Short, where they said it's a revenue measure. The judge in this case is looking to third parties because they're going to help in the rehabilitative aspect of that individual. And also,
isn't the judge a part of the whole thing?
A party?
How can a judge take the word of a man who is the criminal?
Well, I think in any judge,
the only thing that the owner is doing is paying additional taxes.
I don't consider paying additional taxes, and I think the
agreement is understood between the prosecution, the defense, and the judge that the guilty party will pay the fine of the guys that are convicted.
Well, I think we're going one.
Is that all? That's understood.
Well. And
don't
why,
you have any problems with that?
Well, let me explain it, Mr. Justice Marshall. I think we're reading too much into it, and we're reading too much into it because that assumes that the solicitor knew that the employer was going to pay the fine.
I thought you said that was stated in open court.
I don't believe that the solicitor stated in open court. In open court, Mr.
I didn't say the solicitor. I said somebody did.
Right, and that was the petitioner.
And the solicitor
in this case
was there, wasn't he?
That's correct.
So he heard it, didn't he?
Right. But I think the key, Mr. Justice Marshall, in the court is that when an employer in this situation says that he will vouch for this individual, particularly rehabilitative efforts, is he not telling the court that he is going to seek to it that his conduct conforms to the law?
Would it be the same if it was dope?
Would it be the same if it was dope?
That the kingpin of the dope says to the court that I'll pay the fine of these guys.
I think you
would
could
that
say
be that, all right?
I think you could say, because
would
isn't
that be all right?
Isn't that an indication that he's got a stake in this individual and that he's going to conform his conduct to the law?
You think the court would go along with that?
Well, I don't know, but I think it's a reasonable basis, a rational basis for the court to consider. That if somebody's going to pay some money out for them, are they going to continue to hire this individual? And why would they pay the fines if they thought that the conduct to continue, were they going to continue to violate the law? You know, Mr. Zell says to continue to work there would mean that they would violate the terms of their probation. That assumes that the conduct that the employer, in this case, who's vouched for it, is going to continue. And I don't think you can make that assumption.
Well, Mr. Dunsmore. I'm not sure I understand why you think all this is relevant. As the case comes to us, it's been determined by your Court of Appeals that it was established at the revocation hearing that these defendants were not able to pay these fines. That's what the Court of Appeals said. It said at the revocation hearing it was established that none of the appellants had the financial resources to make the payments. And the court held, nevertheless, that makes no difference that you may incarcerate these defendants for failure to pay for the balance of their sentences. In one case, the remainder of a two-year sentence. Now, isn't that the issue that comes as it comes here?
That is correct, and
well,
the Court of Appeals did say.
What difference does it make about third parties, or what the agreement was, or what the anticipation of the judge was?
Well, because
the Court of Appeals took it on the assumption they could not, that it had been determined that they were financially unable to pay.
Well, the Court of Appeals said,
why don't you just defend that, which you do, I'm sure. You defend that even if they couldn't pay and were unable to pay, it was quite constitutional to put them
right in
jail.
And
isn't that your position?
That's correct. And one of the things, we're not, there's no vindictiveness. We're not increasing the sentence at all.
No,
the sentence was, 12 months, $5,000 fine. He could, and as Mr. Justice Rehnquist said, and you said earlier, he could have slapped right off the board, said, in you go, and $5,000 fine.
And what if the sentencing judge had known at the time he imposed it as a condition of probation that the convicted defendants repay $500 a month? What if he had known at that very moment that there was no possibility at all that the defendants could repay.
Well, that question is a little
more. Isn't that just the equivalent?
That's a little more difficult to add, and I think that assumes and would put us in a more difficult position because there's an indication of vindictiveness, and as Mr. Zell said, an illusory. But there's no evidence of any vindictiveness at all in this case, and I think that is an essential matter.
What if he had been morally certain that the defendants couldn't meet one or more of the other conditions of probation?
Well, I agree. I think it makes it far more difficult because there we're impugning bad faith to the judge, and I don't think on the record here there's anything to impugn lack of judicial integrity on the part of the sentencing judge. I don't think we can go that far to say that. And then we're hypothesizing and going into all sorts of realms that are not in the confines of this case. Well, I'm not too sure when he said unique to Georgia. I take it in terms of the fact that judges don't place individuals on, let's say, spend 5 nights in the county jail or work for a health facility. I don't think that's unique because I have, and as outside of the record, I've heard from other individuals that where individuals haven't had to find that, they've either said, well, like, for example, in a traffic case, spend 1 weekend a month driving around with the hospital ambulance authority or something like that. So I don't think it's unique to, but...
This suggestion seems supported by the fact you've had two previous cases in Georgia where was revoked because of inability to pay a fine. And I just don't know whether it arises in other jurisdictions or not in the same way.
Mr. Justice Stevens, I couldn't tell you that, but I don't think that that it's unique because I do know from some limited experience outside that other alternatives depending on who the judge is. But what we're getting back to, or what I believe we need to get back to, is the sentencing discretion of the judge. The fact that other alternatives are available, where he could consider other alternatives, is it unconstitutional to consider financial resources, and is it unconstitutional to enforce the terms of the sentence which is prescribed by law? And that's exactly what we're faced with. And we say it's not. And we say particularly that it's not because there is some element of deception in this case. And as Mr. Justice Marshall said, leading the judge down the path. I, as an attorney, and even as a citizen, would find that somewhat disturbing and irreprehensible that somebody sits down and misinterprets or misleads the court, particularly in the context that we're brought up, particularly the aura of the court. I think most criminal defendants and most individuals, when they're faced in a court situation, tend to be honest. And I'm not supposing in this case that the defendants were less than honest, but they felt they didn't need to speak up and say the third party is paying the fine. I say that after 19 months, particularly on October 23rd, 1978, or even during that period of time, why didn't they go to their attorney and say, look, there's just no way we can pay it? Why wait 3 months until the solicitor goes in and says, I want an order to revoke your probation? Where is the good faith effort on their part? And I think that's fundamental. I think we need to reach that issue, and I think in reaching it, we would hope that the court would say that the trial judge in this case did not abuse his discretion. And we thank you for that.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. Immediately at 1 o'clock,